Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the upcoming third Republican presidential debate and focus on the new frontrunner, Ben Carson, who has taken over the lead in the polls from Donald Trump and already is the target of a dog whistle attack for his religious affiliation with the Seventh-day Adventist Church in a desperate attempt by Trump to influence the evangelical vote by encouraging sectarian bigotry. Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow for religious liberty at Political Research Associates and author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, joins us to discuss what sparks are likely to fly as the candidate who continuously boasts he is a winner and is number one finds himself in second place behind a low-energy brain surgeon who is trying to stick to the high road. Then we'll examine the growing tensions between the US and China over the passage of an American warship within the 12-mile limit of an artificial island the Chinese are creating on a reef in the Spratly Islands between the Philippines, Vietnam, and Malaysia in what is ironically referred to as the South China Sea. China specialist June Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, who was Asia advisor to the chief of naval operations, joins us to discuss whether the nationalist backlash in China that the leadership has encouraged might backfire and force their hand. Then finally, following the WHO report on processed and red meat being linked to cancer, we will look into the forthcoming dietary guidelines for Americans that the USDA and the HHS are preparing that are likely to ignore the latest health warnings because of pressure from the meat industry. Michael Shank, a professor and board member at George Mason University School of Conflict Analysis and Resolution, joins us to discuss how population growth and global warming will make meat production and consumption unsustainable, requiring everyone to switch to plant-based diets, which will be good for the American people and the planet. And joining us now is Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow for religious liberty at the Political Research Associates and the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, and the editor of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America. He is the founder of the interactive group blog, Talk to Action. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Clarkson.
Hi, thanks to be with you again.
And this bit of a spat between the new front runner on the Republican presidential side, Dr. Ben Carson, and Donald Trump, who's previously been ahead, and although I believe it's only one national poll that puts Carson ahead, he's nevertheless well ahead, apparently, in Iowa. And,
yes.
And this has prompted Trump in Florida on Saturday to say, I'm Presbyterian. Boy, that's down the middle of the road, folks, in all fairness. I mean, Seventh-day Adventist? I don't know about that. So that's his dog whistle, which, of course, has resulted in a bit of a flap, and it's likely to be, I think, revisited in tonight's Republican presidential debate. So how do you think this is played for Donald Trump, who seems to be, he's certainly going down in the polls, and most pundits attribute that to a defection by the religious right voters away from Trump to Carson?
Yeah, evangelicals have been looking for their candidate, and a lot of Trump's positions, you know, certainly would be appealing to evangelicals. But as they begin to look more closely at his character, they're beginning to see a lot of flaws. I think that the religion baiting of Ben Carson would be rightfully seen as exactly what it is. They sort of fill in the blanks with that quote and write in Jews or Catholics or, for that matter, evangelicals. And you have somebody saying, oh, I don't know about that, you know, as if to cast suspicion on it. That is the very embodiment of religious bigotry. And anybody who's ever experienced it felt it viscerally.
So do you think then that, as I mentioned, that this will be coming up, and does it work? I mean, we know that you just said that it's a bigoted, certainly a dog whistle bigotry that Trump is engaged in. But on the other hand, I think it's well established that there's a certain amount of bigotry in the evangelical religions against each other. I mean, a lot of these Christian religions are in the business of saying, I've got a monopoly on the truth.
Well, sure. would be true just about any broad swath of religion or non-religion. Everybody seems to think that their faction is more correct than others. You have Reformed Jews who don't think the Orthodox Jews quite have it right, and one group of atheists who doesn't think that the humanists have it quite right, and so on. You see a certain amount of schism and sectarianism that goes on, you know, in any organized grouping. But there's one thing to have a differences of opinion about these things, and even to have fair and accurate disagreements about things and how you interpret Scripture. Well, fine. But it's quite another thing to think that to cast people as somehow less than human, less than equal, somehow less than worthy of respect, and casting suspicion on people's character and integrity based on their religious views. And that's beneath contempt. But we should go back to Donald Trump for a second, who says he's a Presbyterian. He's never said what church he goes to. And I poked around to see what his interviews on the subject. And going back in time, the only church he says he ever attended was the Marble Collegiate Church in New York City, which is affiliated with the Reformed Church in America. Now, the Marble Collegiate Church was best known as the church of the famous evangelist Norman Vincent Peale, who was a best-selling author in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But, Marble Collegiate Church is not a Presbyterian church. Trump says, well, I go to church as often as I can. Well, I have yet to see a picture of Donald Trump, and there are lots of pictures of Donald Trump even going to church. So I really question where he even goes to church and what he believes.
Well, I think the reference to the Seventh-day Adventists was probably a dog whistle to suggest that they're sort of cult-like, you know, like Scientology or Mormonism. They're new, somewhat exotic religion and not your good mainstream Baptist religion.
Sure. Seventh-day Adventists are, you know, a well-established denomination going back to the 19th century. And, you know, it's everyone may think about their beliefs, they're certainly well-known, well-established. And I might add, one of the leading voices for religious liberty, you know, in the religious community going back, you know, for a century and a half. So, there's nothing exotic about the Seventh-day Adventists. I've been published in their magazine called Liberty. I've been on the national radio program of their religious liberty coordinator. So I can speak with as much authority as anybody who's not a Seventh-day Adventist can bring to the occasion that Seventh-day Adventists are very well known and established in American Christianity, and even Billy Graham wanted them to join in his crusades.
Well, we know that this kind of stuff happened with Mitt Romney, this kind of veiled bigotry. And again, I'm speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who is a senior fellow for religious liberty at the Political Research Associates and the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. He's also the editor of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and the founder of the interactive group blog Talk to Action. So obviously, in terms of other sparks that might fly in tonight's Republican debate, is because on Rachel Maddow, Hillary Clinton opened herself up to criticism that she doesn't support America's veterans, and they're obviously going to hammer away at her on that. But do you think that the focus is mostly going to be on these two front runners going after each other? Because Trump does seem to be so sensitive about any kind of criticism, and he keeps talking about, I'm the winner, I'm ahead, this is great, this is fantastic, you know, it's just going to be great, and I'm the number one, and I keep winning, and I'm a winner. But now he's not a winner, he's coming in second. So that's maybe going to change the equation for him a little bit. Do you expect he's going to go after the nice, mild-mannered doctor?
Oh, sure. He'll find a way to do it in a way that probably casts him a little better light. I think he's been trying to be less pugnacious lately. That's hard for him to do, and that's a steep challenge for him. But given that he's been knocked off of the top dog spot, And he won't be the guy at center stage. You know, if CNBC sticks to format, Ben Carson, who's highest up in the polls, will be at center stage and received most of the airtime. This seems to be the way the pecking order works these days. So Donald Trump has got to compete within that arena to gain attention, but without being too mean about it, because I'm sure he has his own internal polls that are just telling him he has to be careful.
Well, one of the interesting anecdotes in Ben Carson's book about himself, which was a bestseller, when he was 14, he let a petty dispute with another young man turn into a tantrum, which had ended up with Ben Carson knifing his friend. And but for the fact that his friend had a belt buckle that blocked the blade, that may have been fatal. And apparently ever since then, Ben Carson's been praying away his anger, quoting him, "My temper will never control me again. Never again, I'm free." But there is, you know, if you suppress the anger and at the same time you're being hectored and baited, I'm just wondering if there's any sort of anything passive-aggressive about the sort of low-key Dr. Carson.
Well, it is a fair question. You know, it's we're electing the President of the United States here, and if there's some untreated psychiatric disorder going on here, that's important and could easily come out in a tough situation. But in fairness to Dr. Carson, he really is a very successful surgeon, you know, and a world-class guy. And as he points out in his, you know, excessively low-key way, you know, he's had to do 20-hour surgeries in his work. So, you know, He's a legitimate brain surgeon, so he does have that going for him, and it requires a certain kind of precision and energy. So, you know, it's hard to speculate about that. But when you see somebody who, just to speculate on the point you're trying to make, Ian, and that's that, you know, he's so controlled in his low-keyness that sometimes people, there's a bit of a seething goes on with people like that. And I haven't tried to wonder to myself, what is it with him? Is there some sort of low boil going on underneath all of that? And that bit of biographical detail suggests that there really is. I think he acknowledges it, and trying to keep it under control is an issue for him. He says he's one, but, you know, it's just like alcoholism and addictions. You know, if it's always a struggle, it's a part of who you are.
So, we'll see whether Trump can bait him in tonight's debate. But my sense about Trump's numbers going down, and apparently the religious right vote is starting to desert him and go to Carson, I suspect, I've always thought that the religious right in this country was basically a front for right-wing politics. Absolutely no distinction between the right of the Republican agenda and 99% of what evangelicals say at the pulpit. They seem to me incredibly political, to the point where you wonder about the separation of church and state. But the point that I want to make is that my sense is that why Trump is losing the evangelical vote is because he's criticizing George W. Bush. He's calling him out on 9/11, which happened on Bush's watch, in spite of the fact that Jeb Bush said, "My brother kept us safe." He's also gone after Bush over the Iraq War, what a catastrophe that was. That should be clear to everybody, but not to partisan Republicans. Do you think that's what's hurting his numbers, that he's just being a little bit of a heretic as far as Orthodox Republicans are concerned, religious or not?
Oh, well, sure. I think going after Jeb Bush based on George Bush's record and trying to essentially imply that Jeb Bush is somehow covering for his brother didn't go down well with a lot of people. Think what you will about his brother. People who are trying to be fair-minded, you know, are not going to blame Jeb for defending his brother.
And they're not going to blame Jeb for what his brother did, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There's a reasonable argument to be made. I mean, if Jeff wants to be his own man, he has to act like his own man. He needs to be able to speak with greater clarity and force about about what happened with 9/11 and his own brother's legacy. And he has so far been unable to do that.
Well, I think he's probably going to go after Hillary, which is, I think, as I mentioned, she's given them the opening a little bit on this veterans issue by suggesting that the VA is not as screwed up as it really apparently is. I mean, it's pretty hard to believe that she could say something like that, because my understanding is that the VA has been captured by an incredibly pernicious bureaucracy that's hard to dislodge, no matter who the leader is of the VA is. And right, there's a big VA campus here in Westwood in Los Angeles, and the last four heads of it are all in jail. So, you know, there's something wrong with, you know, the bureaucrats who have captured the VA and are denying care. But that's not to say that, you know, some vets are happy with their care, but it just seemed to me to be an extraordinary blunder on her part, which billions of dollars are being raised, not just from the Koch brothers, but from another group of billionaires now, to go after her. So my sense is that tonight's debate may be less about the candidates attacking themselves, although there's no way that you can restrain Donald Trump, but more about attacking Hillary. What's your take on it?
Oh, well, sure. But I think that that will be an interesting debate if it's engaged, because the Republicans have chronically underfunded the VA in the first place. So even if there's corruption and bureaucracy in important elements of it, I haven't seen any investigative hearings by the Republicans on that.
Well, but they've been busy with Benghazi. I mean,
well, exactly. I mean, Hillary, you know, can probably make a stronger case for support of the veterans than anybody on that stage it opens the door for Bernie Sanders in a powerful way, because he's one of the best friends veterans have in the entire Congress. Right. He chaired the Veterans Committee in the Senate when he was there. He's the ranking member now. Veterans love Bernie Sanders.
Right. I was about to say Bernie Sanders is the guy that the vets like. So we're just in closing, Frederick Clarkson. Do you think that anything's going to happen in this race, with Iowa being so dominated by the Christian right, to really get to the heart of what I was suggesting earlier, that it's hard to distinguish where theology ends and politics begins with evangelicals? They do seem to be basically a front for right-wing politics.
Well, evangelicals have grown very strong in Iowa politics. I mean, people may not remember that Mike Huckabee came out of nowhere and won the Iowa caucuses in 2008 when he was a much stronger candidate. The religious right failed to unite behind him and later came to regret that. But evangelicals are a powerful force in Iowa, and when they unify, they will determine the winner. But that said, your point about theology and politics merging, never mind separation of church and state, but the distinction between theological views and political views is really eroding in the conservative evangelical and in the conservative Catholic world. And historic and profound alliances have been made there that are going to define our politics for the foreseeable future. Three issues, and they've all articulated these things in a document called the Manhattan Declaration, signed by leading Catholic prelates and top evangelical denominational and political leaders, are sanctity of life, the dignity of marriage, and religious liberty. Three-part agenda that relate to one another, and you'll hear it and see it everywhere you go when you start paying attention, because all of the issues now are being reframed in terms of religious liberty. And I think we will see that increasingly across the election cycle and from all the Republican candidates. So far, none of the Democrats have even addressed it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Frederick Clarkson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who is a senior fellow for religious liberty at the Political Research Associates. He is the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, and the editor of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future and Faith of Politics in America. And he's the founder of the interactive group blog Talk to Action. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the growing tensions between the U.S. and China over the passage of an American warship within 12 miles of an artificial island the Chinese are creating.
But where are the clowns? send in the clouds. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is June Teufel-Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, June Dreyer.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
And what do you make of this escalation, particularly in terms of rhetoric in the Chinese state media after the U.S. sent a destroyer past these artificial islands in the Spratly Archipelago in the South China Sea that China has been building bases and airstrips on? It has really got the Chinese people, at least the netizens, and nationalism seems to be on the rise. The newspapers are warning the U.S. against harassing China and that Beijing is not frightened to fight a war. So how seriously do you take that?
I do take it very seriously, but at this point it's just rhetoric. And we will see what the next phase is, because really this is just a gesture on the United States' part. We've been hinting at doing something like this for a long time. And I read an article in Nouvelle Observatrice of Paris that thinks that this is just a gesture by Obama because he has taken so much criticism for a generally supine attitude toward China, that really this is just going to be a one-off gesture, and it's nothing in particular to worry about.
Well, but how do you control escalation? If it's just a gesture, then if Obama was somehow privately signaling to the Chinese that this is it, you know, we don't want to go any further, that's one thing. But my sense is these things have a life of their own.
Yes. As one of my students, a former Marine, said the other day, it's very easy to get the drums of war beating and very difficult to silence them. And as you pointed out, Chinese public opinion, at least the blogosphere, has reacted very sharply to this. And that, of course, will push Xi Jinping into thinking he should do something. Otherwise, the netizens will become very upset with him for, as Obama has been criticized for, a generally supine attitude. So this could end very badly, but a lot depends on what the next move is. And for example, if Beijing should say, all right, you have trampled on our sovereign rights here, and we have no choice, they always put it that way, but to declare an air defense identification zone in the South China Sea, which, by the way, amusingly, the Chinese just called the South Sea.
I see. Well, how much, though, do you think that the Chinese leadership have painted themselves into a corner? Because ever since Tiananmen, the way that they got rid of aspirations for democracy, particularly amongst the students who demonstrated in Tiananmen, and we all witnessed what happened to them, ever since then, the Chinese authorities have been using nationalism as a way to dampen or distract democratic aspirations. And it seems to have worked. The Chinese are very nationalistic and quite proud of their accomplishments, which are something to be proud of, frankly, in terms of economic development in such a fast clip with a standard of living that's risen faster, I think, than anywhere else in history, probably. So there's a lot to be proud of, but nationalism in itself is a it could be an unguided missile.
It's a two-edged sword because on the one hand, it can prop up the leadership, and on the other hand, if the leadership does not behave in a way that the nationalists that it has stirred up want, it could be used against the Chinese government. And I think that is exactly Xi Jinping's fear. Now, what a lot of Americans who are skeptical of China are saying is that Obama has swallowed this, and therefore he wants to keep on being accommodative to China simply because he doesn't want to put Xi Jinping in a bad position. And this has disadvantages of its own, as you can easily see, because it leads the United States into a position of keeping on accommodating these activists, shall we say politely, Chinese actions for fear of dislodging Xi Jinping. And that's a self-defeating proposition.
And again, I'm speaking with June Dreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization, and Tradition. So there seems to be, though, two things at play here, and maybe that's these two powers are sort of talking past each other. The U.S. doesn't take a position on sovereignty over the South China Sea, but it's insisting about that this is all about freedom of navigation and overflight. But on the other hand, 30% of global trade goes through this narrow area between Vietnam, the Philippines, and Malaysia and China to the north. There's also very rich fishing grounds and potential wealth in undersea mineral deposits and possibly oil as well. So what is this really about?
This is a larger geopolitical confrontation in which the United States, I believe, sincerely is concerned with freedom of navigation. And China insists it has no problem with freedom of navigation, even as it is blatantly disregarding that, because there is no foundation in international law for China's claims, such as this nine dashed line that covers 80%+ of the South Sea. And I am wondering why the West keeps calling it the South China Sea, because the Chinese always just call it the Nanhai, the South Sea. And that actually led a Chinese admiral a couple of weeks ago saying the name says everything. It's the South China Sea. It's ours. So that's dangerous. And meanwhile, the United States does have allies in the area, the Philippines and various other countries. Japan in particular, that we have very close relations with. And the Japanese are very, very worried because they have their own dispute with China over islands they call the Senkaku and actually administer, and that the Chinese claim calling them the Diaoyu. So there really is a contest for geopolitical dominance in this area in which the Chinese are trying to enclose the South and East Sea and really claiming the right to administer the areas, which bothers us.
Well, I think you and I have spoken before about how there are analogies here to the outbreak of World War I, and we just recently observed the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, in the sense that small and apparently or appearingly insignificant issues and treaties, etc., can result in great powers blundering into a war, and these so-called piles of rocks between Japan and Korea and China, and now the Spratlys to the south between Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, and China. Obviously, they're all similar in the sense that they could trigger a wider conflict. So is there a global agreement that could be made here, or are we just going to have these piecemeal incidents?
I don't see any realistic possibility of a meaningful global agreement, it would be phrased in such abstract terms that violating it from one side's point of view would elicit a denial on the other side's point of view that they have, in fact, violated it. So I really don't have any hope of that. Let us hope there is no equivalent of the assassination of the Archduke of the Austro-Hungarian Archduke at Sarajevo. But I can see the Chinese leadership saying it's forced into declaring this ADIS, and then the United States saying, we don't agree with this ADIS, we're going to continue to challenge it, and that will leave the Chinese leadership with the unpleasant choice between do we enforce this or don't we. And so far with the East China Sea ADIS, military planes of both Japan and the United States regularly fly through, and I have been told Korea as well, but passenger planes observe it. So something I suppose, and the Chinese really have not said anything about that, and I suppose something similar could happen, that it's regularly violated, but neither side talks about it for fear of arousing these nationalist pressures. Now, whether that would serve the intended purpose, okay, China, you've done this, but we're not going to obey, because if the rest of the world doesn't know you're not obeying, does it then mean anything symbolically?
Well, in this case, though, it seems a bit brazen to literally create territory by dumping a bunch of sand on some coral reefs and then building an airstrip and literally creating sovereignty, if you will, which is mm-hmm. what's happened here. And I guess the question here is that how would you rate the advantages this gives to China in terms of, you know, extending hegemony over this area, or the backlash from all of these other countries like Brunei, Malaysia, Philippines, Taiwan, Vietnam, Japan, and South Korea, who react to what's happening and are likely to respond by building up their militaries, which is already happening with the Japanese. So I'm just wondering at the end of the day whether China gains anything.
I do think China has gained something. I think it's gained the initiative. And what they are almost doing in a quieter than way than this is going to sound is saying, all right, we've done it. We dare you to do anything. And so far, very little has been done. Now, I understand that Australia is now hinting that it is going to sail an Australian ship within that 12-mile limit. So let's see if that happens. And it is probably going to take a joint effort by more countries than the United States and Australia. But if indeed Australia does this, and even so, it has hinted that it may do it, this is almost a brilliant way of escalation, because it is arguably not the United States, though I doubt Australia would have done this without some conversation with the United States. But it is a second country saying, we're not going to play by your rules. And if then, let's say, India and Japan could sign on to that, that might be a way of responding to China without incurring the danger of a big escalation.
So you'd have this peculiar theater where the Chinese keep piling sand on the Spratlys and building up a base there, while ships of various navies in the Pacific sail around in circles, right? I mean, I guess that's better than going to war, right?
Well, I think you've chosen a very good word there, and it is theater. But even theatrical performances have consequences, and that's what we need to worry about. It is widely accepted that the Chinese plan to fortify these areas militarily. And I inquired into the details of this because living in Miami, as I do, we're very conscious of hurricanes. And I asked if these structures could withstand typhoons and was told that, yes, the Chinese, my engineers, have been very careful to do this and that these structures would withstand typhoons. So do we allow the militarization of these sand piles?
Well, presumably in a typhoon, the sand could be washed away. So presumably then these structures are anchored to the reefs, right, with concrete or something.
Oh, yes, very definitely. Yeah. And there are also seawalls in place, heavy concrete seawalls.
Right.
Now, we all know that Mother Nature is hard to outwit.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the big one here, Hurricane Andrew, buildings to code was considered 100 miles an hour, but Hurricane Andrew did not read the code book and threw 140-something mile an hour winds at us. So I suppose something similar could happen in these South Sea islands.
Well, there's, of course, quite a number of them. The one that's in issue now is called Subi. But there's Gavin, Fiery Cross,
Johnson
South, McKinnon, and Mischief, appropriately named, I guess.
Yes, very much so.
So some of these islands, I understand, are at high tide are almost submerged. So this is quite an engineering feat that the Chinese are involved in.
If they're islands, they're not submerged, because that's the definition of an island.
Right.
But
the reefs, I guess,
Yeah, the reefs, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is quite a feat of engineering, and it's actually not the first. The Japanese have an island whose sovereignty is not contested, although whether it's an island or not is definitely contested. And it is called Okinotori Shima. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Well, where is it near?
It's very south of Japan,
mm-hmm.
and it's very small. Someone has described it as being the size of two futon beds. And about 20 years ago, the Japanese moved in tons of concrete and spread that around the island and then seeded it with coral, I don't know what you call these, proto-corals, which then grow.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is to be able to extend the Japanese exclusive economic zone.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Jundrai, let's just return to how this situation, why it's serious and how it could get more serious. Your main concern is that the Chinese leadership have stoked nationalism, going back to Tiananmen as a way to distract the aspirations of Chinese for more freedom, and it seems to have worked, and that to some extent the Chinese leadership could be hoisted on their own petard, because there's an expectation amongst at least some quarters in China that the Chinese should act. So we don't know exactly what their next move would be, and we don't know what the next U.S. move would be as well. So what's your sense then of whether this is going to be quietened down or escalated?
I think that in the short run, it's going to quiet down. The Chinese have an M.O., if you will, called the Fang Shou. And that is, you let go after the Fang, after a confrontation, a provocation, really, like this. And then you wait for tempers on the other side to abate. And China has a lot of supporters, you know, whatever China does is right kind of thing. And they will say, see, it really wasn't so bad. Let's not tempt the outbreak of war. And things will go back to normal. And then China will show it will move forward again.
Well, I'm reminded when the U.S. aircraft and the Navy aircraft crash landed or had to land on a Chinese island after a collision with a Chinese jet, and this happened right at the beginning of the Bush administration.
Yes, April 1st, 2001.
Right, and the Chinese were quite furious with that. But what they did later was they cut the plane up into small pieces and FedExed the entire airplane to Donald Rumsfeld's home address. So
I did not know that.
Yes, they
That's
did. So,
interesting.
So I'm following on from what you're saying is that they always have a second move, right?
Yes, they do have the next move, right. And we shall see. I imagine what is going on now is in Zhongnanhai, which is where the leaders in China live, is a conversation between people who feel that the initiative is with China and that China should therefore move forward. It's time not to take this anymore. And other people say, no, we're not ready. Deng Xiaoping long ago gave the advice that China should hide its capabilities and bide its time, the so-called hide and bide strategy. But that was 20-something years ago. And some Chinese leaders are saying, all right, it's time to stop hiding and biding. And others are saying, not yet.
Well, Jun Teufeldreier, I thank you very much for joining us.
Always good to talk with you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Jun Dreier, who is a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the new dietary guidelines for Americans will ignore recent health warnings about the consumption of meat by the World Health Organization. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Shank, who's a professor and board member at George Mason University School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. He served as the Associate Director for Legislative Affairs at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, and prior to that, as U.S. Congressman Michael Honda's Senior Policy Advisor and Communications Director. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Shank.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
And just following on from the World Health Organization's report that just came out suggesting that processed meat like bacon, sausages, ham, spam, you name it, is carcinogenic, and red meats might well be carcinogenic too. You've taken the argument, I think, further here in what you've written about how sustainability is really the issue. In particular, it relates into climate change. So, in other words, our global footprint, if you will, both in terms of climate change and in terms of diet, is far too heavy, and that we would be doing our bodies, our own health, a favor by cutting back. And we'd be doing the planet a favor. So that's your simple message, I take it.
That's exactly right. It's good for our health, and it's good for the planet. Most people don't think about food when it comes to climate change. They think about light bulbs. They think about electric cars. They think about solar panels. But our food print is not often considered. The USDA, the Department of Agriculture, is a good example of this. They just issued a statement saying that they will not be including sustainability as part of their national dietary guidelines, despite the fact that the advisory committee, which is made up of medical experts, said, consider sustainability when it comes to food, not only for our individual health, the health of Americans, but also the health of the planet. And that's simply because the not only the health implications, as you've noted with the WHO report, and we know that from other studies from the NIH and Johns Hopkins, there are ample studies out there that link cancer to meat consumption. But when it comes to climate change, the footprint of food is quite big. So the greenhouse gas emissions from the meat consumption globally alone is as high as 22% of all global greenhouse gas emissions, which is a sizable chunk and a very easily reducible chunk if people would eat less meat. Just as an example, one unit of protein of meat is 150 times the amount of GHGs, greenhouse gas emissions, than one unit of protein of soy. So anyone advocating on this isn't saying, hey, get off meat entirely, though I personally have been a vegetarian for 20 years and more recently a vegan. But to the extent that people can eat less meat, it's going to be essential for us to reduce climate change, reduce global warming, and have some kind of sustainable diet for the whole planet.
Well, yesterday I spoke with Marion Nestle, who pointed out that that it's actually the Congress who have prevented the USDA from venturing into issues of sustainability and the impact on climate change and global warming. So there must be a connection, therefore, to the climate science deniers and the anti-science people in the Congress, because the secretaries of agriculture and health and human services, apparently they don't have, even though they don't, they agree with your position, apparently they can't state it.
Well, we know how powerful industries are in Washington, D.C., whether it's the fossil fuel industry shutting down debate in Congress, or in this case, the meat industry, the pork industry, the poultry industry, which have vested interest in making sure the national dietary guidelines are not deleterious to their own industries. As a result, American health suffers and the planet suffers because of the things we mentioned in terms of bad for nutrition and bad for sustainability. So, yeah, to your point about Secretary Vilsack and Secretary Burwell not able to make the right decision for national dietary guidelines, you can look at the lobbying that the meat industry has done in Congress, in Washington, and clearly creating a serious obstacle to American health and sustainability.
So is there, therefore, the only alternative is, well, for example, the WHO report definitely got a lot of press attention. Is this really a case where the people have got to step up if their government fails them?
Well, you know, a lot of environmentalists are changing their light bulbs. They're using more public transit. They're changing their lifestyles, but they haven't yet transitioned to more plant-based diets. They should. So we can lead by example. Individuals can act. If we're going to increase food production 70% by 2050, which is what the UN has said is necessary to account for growth, because we're going to have a population in the realm of 9.7 billion people by 2050, if we're going to increase food production by 70%, we have to do things differently. The reason I'm looking at this issue from a conflict perspective is that the fight over resources is already happening. So the fight over land, the fight over water, the fight over grains, all that's necessary in creating this meat or this pork or this poultry, if we can reduce this middle person and go straight to the plant, we're going to be able to save resources, distribute and manage resources more sustainably, and feed the 9.7 billion globally that we need to feed by 2050. If we don't, if we keep consuming meat, if we keep consuming pork and poultry at the levels we're consuming, you're only going to see more conflict and violence in fighting over those rare resources.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Shank, who's a professor and board member at George Mason University School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, previously served as the Associate Director for Legislative Affairs at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, and prior to that, as U.S. Congressman Michael Honda's Senior Policy Advisor and Communications Director. And as you mentioned, by 2050, we'll need to increase food production by 70% to feed 9.7 billion people, according to the UN. So That's pretty clear, isn't it? That it's finite, that meat is a luxury that the planet won't be able to afford. I mean, it's no small irony that as countries develop a higher standard of living like China and India, the first thing that their people want is is more meat in their diet. So how do you wean the planet, not to mention the United States?
Well, there are a couple low-hanging fruits, so to speak, pun intended, in terms of what we can do to be more wise about our food use. Food waste is a serious issue. 7% of greenhouse gas emissions can be attributed to food waste. Food that we're just not using, that goes to market, gets wasted because of false use-by dates. The product that says use by this date is arbitrary. A company chooses that. The FDA or any kind of food agency doesn't actually force those use by dates. Those are made up by the company. They're often sooner than they need to be so that you as a customer buys more products. So we end up wasting globally 1.3 billion tons of food. That costs us globally $750 billion. So 1.3 billion tons of food wasted. When we should be feeding the planet, we're wasting it. And we're wasting a lot of money in the process. So we could better use that food, and that's just accounting for the food waste. But in terms of transitioning off meat, transitioning off pork and poultry, the problem with most markets or restaurants is that they don't offer yummy alternatives. So, and I can vouch for this as a vegetarian for 20 years, I'm in New York City where there are plenty of opportunities for good vegan vegetarian food, but much of America, as an example, hasn't been exposed to good cuisine. Now, there are great chefs out there creating incredible foods out of plant-based diets. Sam Kass is one of them, former White House chef, who's dedicated to sustainable diets and doing a lot of work with heads of state, cooking up delicious eats solely based on food waste, what we would otherwise waste. But the restaurant community needs to offer alternatives. They are out there. We need to give people delicious alternatives if we're hoping that they can transition and educate and put a price on the emissions associated with these carbon-intensive industries, meat industry, pork industry, poultry industry specifically.
Well, I would personally love to get a good cookbook with vegetarian and vegan recipes, because I'm from Australia and grew up on a meat and potatoes diet, and it's really hard for me to, it's just an expectation that you always have a piece of meat on the plate with the rest of the food. And when you tell me that there are these great chefs that have got all these great recipes, and there aren't enough restaurants around the country, they're mostly in New York. How do you get the word out? I mean, where are the good cookbooks?
Yeah, part of it's there are plenty of structural problems and impediments here too, because we haven't subsidized fruit and vegetables in the way we've subsidized certain grains, and so fruits and vegetables are more expensive because as a government we're not subsidizing them. Also, there are some misperceptions out there about how much protein we actually need to take in. We don't need the kind of protein that we think we need when it comes to meat. And in fact, there are plenty of plants out there that are heavy in protein. So you can get a lot of your protein from seeds and nuts and greens, and in fact, get your sufficient day's worth of protein and not have to rely on meat. But I would certainly welcome you, Ian, if you're ever coming through New York City or Washington, D.C., where I used to work, be happy to take you out to a vegetarian restaurant or a vegan restaurant. But there are cookbooks out there, and we can do a better job supplying those resources to people so that they have alternatives, because I think their notion of a vegetarian diet is probably a Caesar salad that doesn't taste that good, that doesn't have dark greens, and so it's not really healthy for you, and maybe a veggie burger that the chef brought out of the freezer, warmed it up, and as a result, it's not that delicious. So there's incredible alternatives out there. We just need to do a better job in educating and making them available to people who do want to switch off.
Well, my understanding is that, for example, Marion Nestle suggested that we should treat meat as a condiment, which some Mediterranean diets do, and other diets around the world, and I guess in Asia as well, where you don't have a huge big slab of sizzling steak and then, sort of ice cream scoop of a potato and maybe a green, that you reverse that and just have use meat as a kind of condiment to give it a flavor. So is that the way to go?
Well, some people are suggesting just eating meat once a week or eating meat at a certain time in the morning or in the midday or in the evening. So it's not weaning yourself off meat entirely, but just eating less meat. So you can still have your meat, but you're eating less of it, which would also be an alternative to, I think anything that increases awareness, since we're so disconnected with our food, we don't know where it comes from. We don't know about these huge CAFOs that are producing cattle in very small quadrants, and they're not getting a good grassy diet. They're not roaming free. And if someone was in touch with or face-to-face with the animal that they're consuming, they'd obviously consume very differently. I grew up on the farm, so I know very well what it means to have an animal killed right in front of you, or to kill my own chicken that we then ate that night. Obviously, we're not going to increase the likelihood of people's interaction with the food that they're eating, but the more we can educate about where that food is coming from. And then ultimately, campaign finance reform, going back to D.C. for a second, to disconnect industry's hold on dietary guidelines so that the next time the USDA's advisory committee, which is made up of medical experts, says sustainability has to be a consideration for health reasons, nutritional reasons, and sustainability reasons, so we're not fighting over water, land, grains in the future, natural resources, then we can actually have a democratic debate, and USDA and Congress can legislate in a way that's good for the health of Americans and not producing these carcinogenics that the WHO talked about this week that are ultimately bad for our health, cause cancer, etc.
So in other words, we have to change the focus of the USDA and make it actually regulate the meat industry rather than promote the meat industry's products.
Well, and anyone listening to this call can get involved in so many different ways. They can change their own individual diet and not talk to anyone ever and just change the way they eat, reducing a little of the meat, improving or increasing plant-based diets, emailing me for recipes. I'm happy to provide some. mshank@gmu.edu. Happy to talk about good recipes for eating more sustainably. Or they can talk to their neighborhood. They can talk to their restaurants. They can talk to the food suppliers in their community, the markets, and say, hey, I want more plant-based alternatives here because I want to begin transitioning. Or they can call their elected officials and say, I want USDA to do what's right for the health of Americans, for the health of the planet, to follow the advisory committee's recommendations. So there are many, many ways that people can get involved if they want to look out for sustainable diets going forward, because we have to if we're going to survive with the limited resources we have.
Well, thank you very much, Michael Shank. We'll put your email up at ianmasters.com, and I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me in.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Shank, who's a professor and board member at George Mason University School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. Previously, he served as the Associate Director for Legislative Affairs at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, and prior to that, as U.S. Congressman Michael Honda's Senior Policy Advisor and Communications Director. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.